From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump tweeted today that he's feeling great. And White House physician Sean Conley says the president is reporting no symptoms, even though he is not out of the woods yet with the coronavirus. Returning to the White House from the hospital last night, the president tweeted out this message about COVID-19.
Don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it. You're going to beat it. We have the best medical equipment. We have the best medicines, all developed recently.
About 210,000 Americans have died after contracting COVID-19 and millions infected. And NPR national correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Tonya.
This morning, the president in a tweet again erroneously compared the coronavirus to the seasonal flu. Last night, he climbed the White House stairs, publicly took off his mask, and then was in close proximity to staff as they videotaped his return. What's been the reaction to all of this?
Well, his critics and public health experts say that he's being irresponsible to tell people not to be afraid of COVID. It's no big deal. He even tweeted that he feels better than he did 20 years ago, as if it's a kind of youth serum to get COVID. So he's gotten a lot of criticism for that. But White House aides say that removing his mask when he returned to the White House is not a big deal. Alyssa Farah, who's a White House press aide, said that the president wanted to project a, quote, image of strength. That's why he appeared on the balcony and took off his mask. So, you know, that's what the message they want to send. And there's critics who say he's sending exactly the wrong message for people.
Well, I mentioned a little bit of what White House physician Sean Conley said about the president's condition today. But what's the latest that we know about the president's health?
Well, what we know is that the president is healthy enough to do a lot of tweeting. He's been doing that today. But he also said, Sean Conley, the president's doctor, said he had a restful first night at the White House. He has no symptoms. But yesterday he told us that Trump was not out of the woods yet. It's really important to watch him over the weekend. He said that we're in a bit of uncharted territory because the president is getting some therapies and drugs earlier in the course of illness than most people do.
There's also an outbreak in the White House. What more can you tell us, and what precautions are being taken to keep staff safe?
There's no doubt that there's more mask wearing right now at the White House. And according to Franco Ordonez, our reporter who is physically there today, it's very quiet. The lights are on in the press area. Some staffers are working at the White House. We know that other ones have been allowed to work from home. There's not a whole lot of difference at the White House. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of staffers that are nervous about getting COVID, so more mask wearing. That's the biggest difference that we can see.
And are there any updates on the conditions of some of the others who have tested positive for coronavirus? Chris Christie, Melania Trump, Kellyanne Conway?
Yeah, well, there has been a lot of White House aides and outside consultants like Chris Christie who've gotten it. We know that Chris Christie went to the hospital. We know that Melania Trump has been described as doing fine. Kellyanne Conway also appears to be working from home. Her daughter has posted messages on TikTok and other social media platforms that she has also gotten COVID. But we also know that Kayleigh McEnany, the press secretary, has gotten COVID. A military aide is reported to have gotten it. And what we don't know is what about the support staff, mostly Black and Hispanics, mostly older individuals who work in the West Wing or in the residence, they might have been exposed too.
Do you know if there are any contact tracing efforts happening in the White House or with health officials?
Well, that's one of the big questions. We don't have any evidence that the White House is doing anything more than minimal contact tracing, and they're not asking the CDC to help them. Contact tracing is basically where you try to notify people who might have come into contact with an infected individual that they should get tested and that they should potentially quarantine. But that is not happening.
Mm-hmm. Mara, the president insisted in his video message also that vaccines would be available momentarily, but that's not at all certain. Today's New York Times reports how White House officials are blocking FDA safety guidelines that could slow down the rollout of a vaccine until after the election. Is this a White House that recognizes that this election right now seems to have boiled down to just one issue, really, the president's illness and his handling of it?
I think so. There's really no avoiding that right now. He tried very hard before he got sick to try to make this election about something else other than his leadership in the pandemic. But right now, the White House and the Trump campaign appears to want to make the president's illness into a metaphor. He's tough. He's strong. Mm-hmm. He beat it. Mm-hmm. It's not so bad. But that strategy depends on his continuing to improve. And we're just going to have to wait and see about that.
Mara Liasson is NPR's national political correspondent. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump's actions are having an impact in Senate and House races across the country. Let's go to Michigan now for this week's Here and Now District Profile, looking at House races ahead of the election. There is a competitive race in the 3rd congressional district there, where Republican Peter Meyer is running against Democrat Hillary Scolton to fill the seat of Congressman Justin Amash. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer joins us from Grand Rapids. Dustin, first of all, how is the news about the pandemic and the president going over where you are?
Well, there's a lot of local things happening here in Michigan that I think in some ways overshadow what's happening with the president. Just last week, we had a state Supreme Court decision that affected the governor's emergency order for how people in Michigan would behave. So I think top of mind for most people in Michigan are these local issues more so than the national issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about the 3rd congressional district. Justin Amash was a Republican. Then he left the party, very famously voted for the impeachment of President Trump. Can you describe the district for us and how it usually votes?
Well, the district includes the area around Grand Rapids, which is the 2nd largest city in Michigan. It's on the west side of Michigan. The district has been traditionally a Republican district, not just traditionally, but going back 100 years, only one other Democrat has held this seat in the past 100 years. That was Richard van der Veen, who won election here in a special election after Gerald Ford ascended to the vice presidency. So there's a long history of Republicans winning this area, and it's a toss-up really for the first time in anyone's memory around here.
Now, the Republican candidate this time around is Peter Meyer, and I will say that he is a member of the Meyer family. I remember when I was a kid in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, going to Meyer to play Meyer tag, because it's like a huge Walmart, basically. Peter Meyer is an Army veteran. Here's an ad that he put out this summer.
Hey, everybody, it's Peter Meyer here. I'm a Republican running for Congress in West Michigan, and I hope to earn your vote. Limited government, economic freedom, and individual liberty. These are the foundations upon which all of our country's success is built. And they're also the foundation that we can use to solve the problems of today and tackle the challenges of tomorrow.
What is he running on, and what are the big issues that he's talking about?
Well, Peter Meyer, that's M-E-I-J-E-R, as folks in the Midwest will know. He is running on his record of service in the military and really running on a lot of traditional Republican, what we would have thought of before Donald Trump, traditional Republican values of limited government, of balanced budgets. He's really talking a lot like, say, Mitt Romney, who ran for the presidency and did very well in Kent County in 2012 by appealing to voters.
Does Meyer talk about President Trump at all? Does he get asked about President Trump?
There's a difference between how he talked about him in the primary and how he talked about him at the most recent debate with Scolton. In the primary, he was embracing him much more. The only criticism he really leveled at Trump was that he wasn't so happy about the government spending that's happened under Trump. More recently, in the latest debate with Scolton, he said he would have no problem disagreeing with President Trump and going against President Trump. But he's really not focused on Trump, obviously, or maybe not obviously, but Hillary Scolton is trying to make more of a connection between him and Trump, and particularly around the area of health care and what would happen with the Affordable Care Act.
Hillary Scolton worked at the Department of Justice under President Obama. Here's a recent ad from her.
My faith is what calls me to serve, what led me to the Department of Justice and back home to West Michigan. In Congress, I'll defend Michigan jobs, protect our water and people with pre-existing conditions.
Tell us more about Scolton and what she's been campaigning on.
She put the faith part really forward. She is a Christian and talks about that a lot. That is something that many people in this area are religious and identify as Christian. So that is one way that she has sort of tried to cross over with certain voters. She also says she grew up Republican. At the last debate, she mentioned she didn't even know any Democrats until she was a senior in high school. So she's really talking a lot about sort of shared values. And in addition to talking about her faith, she's really talking about healthcare. She says that's the thing that people bring up most to her when they meet her in person, is talking about what will happen with the Affordable Care Act. So those are really her top issues that she's talking about.
And are there polls, and what do they say?
The polls say it's close. If you talk to a lot of the pundits and a lot of the people who track these types of races, it's really a toss-up. In particular, the Skolten campaign cites some internal polling where they claim they're actually ahead, which would really be surprising because, as I said, a Democrat hasn't held this seat since Watergate.
That is Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer in Grand Rapids. Dustin, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
We're about a month into the school year for many American students, and in some places, students are actually in the classroom. Maybe not every day, maybe not with all of their classmates, but there is more in-person learning happening. Let's check in now with two students who are doing a mix of remote learning and in-person classes. Josh Fried is a junior at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Hi, Josh.
Hello.
And Ben Shapiro joins us as well. He's a high school sophomore at Friends Seminary in New York City. Welcome to you, Ben.
Hi, thanks.
Well, and let me start with you, Ben. School started for you last month. How are things going so far, especially the in-person part?
It's definitely strange, but I think it's going relatively well. I'm happy I get to see my friends, and I'm happy that I get to learn. There are problems with communication, and it's difficult, especially when you're trying to talk to a room of people and the mask like stops sound from going out, so it makes it harder to hear, and it's been a challenge.
How much time are you spending in the classroom, and how much time are you doing remote learning at this point?
So I am in school one day a week, Wednesday, for three and a half hours, and then the rest I am on Zoom.
And do you find a major difference in how much you're able to learn when you're in school versus when you're on Zoom?
Personally, yes. I am a very visual and active learner, so I think interaction is really important for me to kind of absorb the information. And with Zoom, that is much more difficult. But I think that because I was able to have an encounter with online learning last spring, I'm a little more used to it.
And Josh, what about you? You are in college. You're at Carnegie Mellon, a junior. How much time are you spending in the classroom versus doing things remotely?
Yeah, for me, it's about half classes are in person, half are on Zoom.
And how is it going so far?
Things are going as well as they can be. One of the biggest challenges I think we've been trying to face is having half the students online and half in person, because there's a lot of issues with students being heard on the computer versus students being heard in class, and how the teacher is able to facilitate those two mediums.
Do you feel unsafe at all when you have to go in person into the classroom with so many people?
I don't particularly feel unsafe, because I feel that my university is doing quite a good job like enforcing guidelines. It does, though, feel a bit unnatural. Just making sure that you're keeping distance from your friends is definitely an odd thing.
Mm-hmm. And is everybody wearing masks?
Yeah, everybody is wearing masks. At least the professors that I have been very strict about making sure that students don't enter the classroom too quick a rate so that everyone's able to distance, making sure that our desks remain on top of the taped markers that the university has put on the floor. Yeah, a little protocols like that.
And are you getting tested regularly?
So when everybody arrived to campus, we were told we had to do a two-week quarantine, and so far it seems that people have done that. And then after that, we were all tested by the university. And now they're doing random asymptomatic testing and then posting their results on their webpage, which seems to be doing quite well, as there haven't been quite, I think, any new cases recently.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Ben? Are you getting tested at all to go into the classroom?
So my school's not requiring us to get tested unless there are specific scenarios, right? So if you were outside of the state and you come back in, you have to take 2 weeks and then get tested. Or if you have been close to someone that has tested positive, but it really just consists of a survey. If you pass, you're allowed to go into school and taking your temperature when you walk in the door.
Mm-hmm. What kind of restrictions are there in the school, Ben? I mean, we heard Josh talking there about some of the, you know, tape on the ground and making sure that people are staying at a certain distance. What about in your school?
We have markers placed on the floor. We have our desks there, and we're not really allowed to move around. If we want to move around, there's a path in the back of the classroom where we go to the garbage or get a tissue or hand sanitizer. So they are really trying to separate us.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a very difficult situation for everybody involved, and I'm sure it is difficult as a student. What would you say to your school administrator, to the principal, to the superintendent about what you think ought to happen in the months ahead? I'll start with you, Ben.
I think really just play it by ear, right? Get professional opinions and keep updating those opinions. And I think that they should prioritize safety, but also try to get us the interaction needed to be mentally healthy.
Ben, when do you think this is all going to be over and things will go back to normal?
I think we'll see the lasting effects of this for a really long time, but I hope we have a vaccine in mid-2021, but I don't have an answer for that.
Josh, let me finally go back to you. You live with five other roommates. You're the only one from your apartment that actually attends classes in person. How do your roommates feel about that? Are they concerned?
I don't think that I'm extremely concerned. We're all very confident in like the university's handling of this so far. If anything, it makes my classmates feel my roommates feel more hopeful that things could continue to move closer to a more in-person centered format.
Are people going to parties on campus?
I haven't seen any. Those students who do, I think that that's very silly and very poor judgment.
When do you think this will be over?
Similar to what Ben said, I don't think that there'll be like a concrete end to this.
That is Josh Fried, who is a junior at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And we've been speaking with Ben Shapiro, a high school sophomore at Friends Seminary in New York City, both doing hybrid learning, some in person and some remote. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine gave K-12 students the all clear to play sports this fall, but left the final decision up to each school district. In Akron, the school board ended up allowing students to play, in part because some said it's an issue of equity that's worth the risk. Jenny Hamill from WCPN IdeaStream has the story.
Got him buried. We got him pinned. We're closing. We should get a tackle. That's good.
It's Saturday afternoon, and the players on the Kenmore Garfield High School football team are going through some drills. These players were really close to not having a season, and they lost several weeks of practice time. So now that they're back out on the field, there's an added layer of gratitude mixed in with all that sweat.
Ready!
Yep.
All right.
Set.
Go!
3D. 3D.
17-year-old Tyjon Gary is playing quarterback for the team this year. He doesn't mince words when you ask him just what getting to play means.
Football to me is life. Like, I've been doing this since I've been 6, 7 years old, every day, nonstop. And everybody out here be doing the same thing.
Gary will also tell you that having a season his senior year means more chances to make big plays during games. And that means more film to put on a highlight reel. He says his chances for college bank on this.
For me, this is my only way out. So if I don't make it to college, I'm going to just have to work a job the rest of my life.
You got to be here, man, commanding the situation, saying go.
That's Kenmore Garfield's head football coach, Kemp Boyd. He says that for several of his seniors, bringing that kind of intensity onto the field this year will be their best chance to get into a Division II or III university or a junior college. He remembers that soon after the Akron School Board voted against letting fall sports go forward, Tyjon told him over the phone he might have to transfer.
He really didn't want to leave, but he said, Coach, man, I don't see any other opportunity for me to have an inroad to go to college outside of being able to play football. And if I can't play, then I'm hurting my chances of college. And that's what really made me kind of wake up the next morning and say, man, I got to start calling some people.
Boyd says that for the young men on his team, they've always seen themselves as the have-nots compared to the haves. It's been no different during the pandemic.
Everything that's getting dictated to our young people is, hey, you're going to go virtually, and also we're taking away sports from you. So for me, that was just an equity issue.
And Boyd says coming to the field almost every day provides a safe haven away from the violence swirling around these young men. In August, Akron police reported homicide rates had gone up 50% since 2019, and gun violence had surged dramatically too.
But the young men that I coach, which a majority of them look like me, they have a higher chance of dying through street violence, through gunshot, than they do to COVID.
Good, good, good.
But they also know COVID-19 is a very real risk. The coaches wear masks on the field, and there's other safety protocols in place, too, like no locker rooms. But the coaches, players, and their parents seem to be on board. Austin Druhard is a senior on the team.
I think it's a risk everyone's willing to take, because when we got the game taken away from us, it really hurt a lot of us. So I feel like having this back, everybody knows the risks, and they're willing to work with it.
Druhard and the other Kenmore Garfield Rams have been told that what they do off the field to keep themselves safe from COVID-19 is just as important as what they do on the field, and it's something they abide by.
Rams on three, Rams on three! One, two, three!
Rams! For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Hamill in Cleveland.
Today, there are mixed messages about the latest on the United Kingdom's efforts to reach a trade deal with Europe ahead of its actual exit from the European Union on January 1st. EU sources are cited as saying the latest negotiations have been the most positive so far. But another report says the two sides are on the edge of a cliff. Joining us now is the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson. Rob, I feel like we've heard this before, mixed messages on Brexit.
Heard it before? Really, Jeremy? I mean, actually, it seems like we've been discussing this off and on ever since the referendum back in 2016. Can you believe it?
Right.
Really interesting, though. I should just begin by pointing out, what those on the Remain side of the argument would say. Hang on a minute. I thought the people who'd been in the Vote Leave campaign, the people who are now in the British government, I thought they'd said this would be the easiest deal in the world.
Right.
And of course, it's proving anything but. Look, in terms of sort of scoring it, are they really about to go off that? You know, will they get a deal? Won't they get a deal? It's just incredibly hard to say, Jeremy. I mean, on the one hand, you would say it's very much in the interests of both the UK and the European Union, politically, economically, in every way, to do a deal. But will they? I don't know.
What is the sticking point right now? Why are things so bad?
Do you know, in a funny sort of way, The sticking point is what it's been right from the start, and that is when Britain voted to leave the European Union, in many ways what Britain wants is everything that it liked about its membership of the EU, free trade and all that kind of stuff, and none of the things that it didn't like being a member of a political club and having to sacrifice its sovereignty. And the position from the European Union has always been, right from the start, you know, hey guys, you know, we respect your vote to leave, but here's the thing. You know, if you're going to vote to leave the club, you know, you don't get to use the shower and all the other good things about gym membership. That's the deal. So, you know, you can look at specifics, and to some extent it's about things like to what extent could Britain subsidise certain industries that it wants to. You know, to some extent it's about what happens to all the fish that live and swim around the UK. But I think it's that bigger issue of, to what extent is the European Union, you know, prepared to cut the UK a deal which is sort of almost as good as membership and not quite?
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is a big, you know, vote leaver, has gotten much more involved in the talks himself. What does that mean?
Well, it suggests to me that you've reached that point where the officials, the diplomats, have sort of done what they can, and now you need the big political decisions, which I think really comes down to which side is more likely to blink, the UK or the EU. and to what extent both sides are mutually worried about the danger of a no deal. And, you know, if you were to put me on the spot and say, what do you think's going to happen, Rob? And I would say it was more likely that the UK is going to blink. Countervailing against that, you know, as you said, Boris Johnson, he's part of the Vote Leave campaign. He's surrounded by some pretty ideological people. And some of them are just thinking, you know what, we just don't want to make any compromises with the EU sovereignty, Trump's economics. And if that is the case, then, you know, there's a good chance that there won't be a deal.
That is the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, with the latest twists and turns on Brexit.
Over the last few weeks, we asked you to submit questions about voting this election, and we've received plenty from you through our questionnaire at hereandnow.org, by email, social media, and by phone. Here to help us answer a few of them is Edward Foley. He's a professor and director of the Election Law Program at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Professor, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Yes. So our first question was submitted through Instagram, and it's a simple but very common one. How do I confirm I'm registered to vote?
If you have access to a computer with the internet, you should go to your local Board of Elections website, because many local election officials will let you verify this online. Some do not, and then you'd have to get their phone number and call in. But it's easier to do it online where that's available. Sort of a basic point in all of this is election law varies state to state, and sometimes even city to city, town to town. And so when I say something, I'll give you the kind of general rule or general mm-hmm. practice, and it may not apply in every instance, but many places now you can do this online.
Yes. We've received a lot of questions about voting in Pennsylvania specifically, which is probably one of the most consequential states in this election. The state's Supreme Court ordered officials to throw out so-called naked ballots, those without a secrecy envelope, which is that second envelope over the first one. Those will not be counted. So we have a question from Steve Goldblack. He lives just outside of Philadelphia, and he left us a voicemail of his question. Let's listen.
I'm curious, if a ballot is thrown out, is the person who submitted the ballot notified so that they can come in person and vote?
This is a very good question, Professor. Do you have an answer for Stephen?
It is a good question. It's my understanding of Pennsylvania law, which is quite in flux at the moment because of all the controversies there, is that the state legislature has a bill pending that would allow for that kind of notification. Other states do that. It's a very good practice, but Pennsylvania would need to update its rules to make for that sort of notification, to bring their laws up to speed to what other states do. So I think that's one where you have to stay tuned on that particular issue for that particular state.
Sure. And this is an issue that's very concerning for people all over the country, because more people than ever are voting by mail. We have another question from Joni Lerman of Kentucky, who has a similar question about voting in Pennsylvania.
I have requested and received my absentee ballot, and there's a way of tracking it, I understand. And I wondered if there is a way of tracking absentee ballots for people in Pennsylvania.
Professor, are voters in Pennsylvania able to track the status of their absentee or mail-in ballots?
Well, yes and no. Pennsylvania does have a version of this, as do other states. But the last I saw through Twitter and social media was there were some glitches and problems with that, unfortunately. So part of it is that Pennsylvania is converting to what's sometimes called no-excuse vote by mail or no-excuse absentee voting, where anybody can choose that method of voting if they want to for whatever reason. And this was going to be the first year that Pennsylvania was going to do that, even before the pandemic hit. And so it was going to be a challenge to roll out this new system. And it's obviously an even greater challenge with the pandemic. And of course, as you say, it's a battleground state. So I think the answer is yes, this tracking process exists, but it may be a little bit glitchy, unfortunately.
Stacey Haynes from Wisconsin emailed her question, which reads, In the mail this week, I got an application for an absentee ballot with a picture of the president and the words, "President Trump wants you to return this form." I didn't request the application. It's addressed to someone who used to live here or current resident. I'm confused. He says voting by mail isn't safe, so why did he send me an application to vote by mail? Oh, this is a really interesting one.
And it's complicated, unfortunately. I think the best way to think about this is to say not everything that happens in the voting process is the way it should happen. And I also think non-governmental entities can encourage people to vote and to vote absentee and to try to have their flyers look like official business. Again, this also varies state to state. So the way in which I would handle this is to ask, did anything happen here that would undermine the integrity of the election, that would compromise the ability of the system to do it properly? And I think the answer to that, based on what I hear, is no. I mean, you might wish it hadn't occurred this way. You might wish pictures shouldn't be on particular flyers. You might be confused about what kind of mailing that I've got. But if you're the voter, ask yourself, you know, have I figured out my method of voting? Every voter should have a plan to how they're going to vote and not be distracted by sideshows. So if you know you're going to vote in person, you know, don't worry about collateral stuff that might come in the mail that doesn't really undermine your vote. If you want to vote by mail and you see a piece of paper that's not, you're not sure if it's a legitimate piece of paper on, then you might say, well, let me take a real close look at this. If it's a ballot application, again, it's not your actual ballot, you're going to have to take two steps to the process. One is send in an application to request your ballot and then get your ballot back. Anybody who wants to vote by mail should be either have already applied for a ballot already or being very proactive at this point, because time is of the essence given the Postal Service and whatnot. And so trusted sources is key. You know, find out from your local board what's the proper way to apply and cast an absentee ballot. Don't trust just any old flyer that shows up.
Right, because we receive so many flyers, so many mailers during this time of year anyway. It's sometimes hard to differentiate what is actually a credible mailer and what is junk mail, for lack of a better word.
No, that's absolutely true. And unfortunately, there are, and this happens every year or every presidential cycle, there are more shady groups out there that try to do disinformation and confuse voters, unfortunately. And so voters have to be alert. And along those lines, it's easy, unfortunately, to be tripped up, especially if you're not used to voting by mail and you've always voted in person. So get a quiet zone for yourself. Just take the time to read the instructions carefully. You don't understand the instructions, have somebody else kind of help process what is it that's expected of me. If you take the time to do it slowly, you're much more likely to do it successfully.
I have just a few more short questions for you. Most states or many states do offer supplementary booklets that tell you what proposals are on the ballot and what local election details are on the ballot. But one listener wants to be informed on the issues before heading to the poll and asks on Instagram, where can I find a list of amendment proposals for my state?
Yeah, the League of Women Voters usually does a really good job with that. I would put them in the category of trusted information, particularly on that kind of voter information. Usually the Secretary of State's office and website will have that information because they have to approve the language for ballot measures like that. Sometimes local newspapers will have a section of their website devoted to election-related information, but the League of Women Voters is generally very reliable on something like that.
And the last question that really a lot of people have, someone asks, I hear so often from other people, does my vote really count? Does it?
Yes, it absolutely does. And there are these very sad circumstances where a particular voter will make a mistake or the post office will make a mistake. And you know, you want to have zero mistakes or problems like that, but it's a human process. so you can't guarantee 100% perfection. On the other hand, democracy is a collective enterprise. We're doing this for each other, not just for ourselves as individuals. So understood from that collective perspective, yes, our votes completely matter because we do this as a group, and it's our group determination is what determines who holds office in our behalf on our name. And so, yes, it absolutely matters.
Edward Foley is a professor and director of the Election Law Program at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Thank you so much for answering our questions today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded today to an American astrophysicist, Andrea Ghez, for the discovery of a supermassive compact object at the center of our galaxy, a black hole. She shares the prize with two other scientists, German astrophysicist Reinhard Genzel and British mathematical physicist Roger Penrose. Andrea Ghez is a professor of astrophysics at UCLA and the director of the UCLA Galactic Center Group. She joins us now by Skype. Professor, welcome and congratulations.
Thanks so much.
I want to start with a question that should be very easy for you at this point, given that you just won the Nobel Prize for research into this. Tell our listeners, what is a black hole?
Well, a black hole is a region of space where the pull of gravity is so intense that nothing can escape it, not even light.
Okay, and so tell us about your research into this. You discovered a supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. How were you able to find it?
My work used the Keck telescopes, which are out in Hawaii, and it's the largest telescope in the world. And the reason that's important is that with large telescopes, the larger your telescope is, the finer the detail you should be able to see. And my group has worked on techniques for getting to the sharpest images that we can obtain. And doing so allows us to see the heart of our galaxy. And what we wanted to know is there a supermassive black hole there? And so by taking these incredibly sharp images, we were able to discover stars at the heart of the galaxy and track the motion of these stars. And the motions of the stars contain the answer to what resides there. And these stars move so incredibly fast that you know that there's a lot of mass confined within a small volume, which is the demonstration of a supermassive black hole.
So the prize today is for both the observation of black holes, your work and Reinhard Genzel's work, and also the theoretical side of black holes, Roger Penrose's work on that. What are some of the big questions that you're still hoping to answer about black holes?
Oh, gosh, there are so many. So from the physics side, what one really wants to understand is how does gravity work near a supermassive black hole? Because black holes, in a sense, represent the breakdown of our understanding of physics. We don't know how to make the theory of gravity, Einstein's theory of general relativity, work together with the theory of quantum mechanics, which is the study of things that are very small. So black holes have both massive gravity or lots of gravity and are very small objects. So that's the physics side of the house. And then astrophysically, what we want to understand is the role that these supermassive black holes play in the formation and evolution of galaxies, which are the building blocks of the universe.
You are the fourth woman to win the Nobel Prize in Physics. Women are as you know, underrepresented in the field. What would you say today to other women, physicists, and maybe young girls interested in science?
Oh, gosh, you know, I think science is so much fun. And if you're interested in it and have a passion for it, go for it. It astounds me that today there are so few women in the field and so few women recognized. So that's why I actually I take very seriously the sort of the responsibility in being recognized with this award for being a role model.
How early was it that you first got interested in black holes and physics and science?
You know, hindsight is 20/20. I think when I was young, I was certainly inspired by the early moon landings. That was my first introduction to really thinking about the universe. And I was quite young. I was four when we first landed on the moon. But that, if I think back, was the early inspiration that got me thinking about, you know, this immense universe, realizing how small and insignificant we were. But I wouldn't say that I was somebody who knew beyond a, you know, shadow of a doubt that I wanted to go into this field. And in fact, I went to college thinking I wanted to be a math major. So I would say the common theme for me growing up was that I always loved puzzles and figuring things out. I loved logic puzzles. And today I really think of my research as one giant puzzle and thinking of technology as a way of, you know, figuring out the next piece of the complex puzzles that we have.
So finally, let me just ask you what it was like this morning. You obviously knew that the prize in physics was going to be announced today, and you knew from what happens every year that it's going to be a call very early in the morning. But what was it like for you when that call came to you?
Oh, gosh, I was fast asleep. So, you know, the first thing is to realize the phone is ringing. And then the second thought is, oh, no, who's sick? And then, you know, sort of disbelief, you know, and then being thrilled. I still am having a hard time completely wrapping my head around it. But I'm really delighted.
That is Andrea Ghez, who is one of the winners of the Nobel Prize in Physics today. She is a professor of astrophysics at UCLA and one for her research into black holes. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations once again.
Thanks so much.
And tomorrow we'll find out who wins the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.